Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. A man I went to Vietnam with 50 years ago in 1966 died this past Saturday, April 23rd. He was from Oregon, but died in Texas. His name was Ira Stephen Russell. After Vietnam, he was assigned stateside as a DI. Discharged from the USMC, he knocked around for a couple of years, primarily albacore fishing off the Pacific coast. He re-enlisted for officer candidate school, and as an infantry captain, he helped evacuate the last U.S. Marines from Vietnam at the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, now Ho Chi Minh City, in April 1975. Not long after that, he experienced his last combat on a Cambodian island in which 100 Marines were killed and wounded erroneously, believing they were rescuing the crew of a hijacked U.S. freighter, the Mayaguez. He retired a few years later as a lieutenant colonel. One of his daughters said he had planned to start a new quilt the day he died. It should not be surprising that fisher people are experienced knitters or quilters. They have to know a profusion of knots and use of needles to mend nets. I have known many who watch their fish lines knitting stuff for friends and family. Ira and I had disagreements about the war and a few other things, but he always held close to his heart the bond of 50 years ago, and the fact that both of us had also been ocean tuna fishermen added a layer to that. So I dedicate this program to Ira Russell on the eve of the end of the Vietnam War 41 years ago on April 30th, 1975, and to his part in rescuing the last Americans to leave Vietnam. The day after April 30th is May Day, and I start today's rather varied program with something I have written and revised many times. If there is an adhesive to today's smorgasbord of a program, three poems by Margaret Lee Bowler provide it. Start with May Day. A call for rebellion, a call for change, a call for help. May Day, the ancient celebration of spring, the festival of rebirth. May Day is celebrated all over the world in every culture and kitchen. For many, it is Labor Day in honor of the anonymous billions who break their backs or wear out their nerves for their daily bread. It is the symbol of seeding the earth in hope of a good harvest to ease the dreadful hunger that stalks the human race. May Day is also a day of revolution, a charge against history that demands sweeping changes among the world's societies. This claim usually originates from compassion and the perception that there is no excuse for anyone to go hungry, be without shelter, or denied adequate health and medical care. It is the demand for freedom and respect for all the world's people. The world situation perpetually eludes optimists and idealists. The balance of wealth and distribution of resources is dismally inequitable, which intensifies the disparity between rich and poor. Millions are out of work, their lives ruined by poverty and economic collapse. Millions more die from famine and epidemics. The old especially suffer. They are too often abandoned to starve or freeze. Children are malnourished and preyed upon. Their hungry, pleading faces stare at us from everywhere. Oppression, tyranny, and corruption infect the world's governments. World leaders move pitifully against their own peoples and their neighbors. Armies and police murder innocent people in retaliation for terrorist acts, which perpetuates terrorism. Populations are major targets of wars, contrary to pious perfidy, which makes war itself a foremost and persistent act of enormous terrorism. The terror of nuclear annihilation looms iconically more than 70 years after the first atomic bombs obliterated two Japanese cities and gave birth to the nuclear age. We have built a global greenhouse and we dwell within. We have pummeled and plundered our home planet as if it offered an inexhaustible feast without charge or cleanup, but the consequences of our careless and excessive indulgence are converging, approximate with our disregard and denial. Our probable proximity to extinction is not from any single cause or danger or combination of them, but because we seem helpless as well as unwilling to undo the damage or change direction. Our paradox is that our opulent civilization is based on processes that threaten to obliterate it, and we will most likely strangle on the effluence of our affluence. This already chaotic and frenzied adolescent millennium is an X-ray of our history, which lies behind us like an immense junkyard that seems cluttered with artifacts of no use to us anymore. We try to escape history as if by accelerating past we are Teflon'd, but history brought us to where we are and made us who we are. Millennialism evokes old prophecies, apocalyptic cults that believe the end of history is at hand, flourish, and seize theological power all over the world. Inexorable, bipolar dogmata, armed with the means to achieve what ancient prophecy continues to incite. The poets might be right after all. The prospect of peace is more irrational than the dark, brooding desire for murder each of us hosts like a malevolent gene. Humanity's penchant for sinister error, folly, mass psychosis, and loathsome horror gives us our sense of humor, our appreciation of the comedy of inescapable death. Yet optimism persists, perhaps because, in even the worst of times, our predecessors always raised a maypole for themselves and their children to dance around. Perhaps especially in the worst times, it is necessary to hope. And because May Day is a ribbon around Earth Day, which happened to have its 46th anniversary this past April 22nd, I read the first of Margaret Bowler's three promised poems, Earth's Checklist, an Earth Day poem by Margaret Leah Bowler. Say what you think what you say, for what would Mother Nature do if she saw her Earth this way? If she saw all the pollution, all the smog, all the waste, all the careless forest fires, all the killings just from taste, all the rainforest destruction, the acid pouring from the sky, the shooting, the logging, killing species by and by, all the deadly fertilizer being sprayed upon the ground, the oil clogging up the beaches, yet the world is going round. What would Mother Nature do? What would Mother Nature do? First, she would put a stop to pollution, clear the acid from the sky, prevent the careless forest fires, save each species by and by, stop the rainforest destruction and the smog and the waste, halt the shootings and most logging and the killings just from taste, ban the deadly fertilizer, start to clean up the ground, make our home a better place the whole world round. But Mother Nature softly speaks, her voice is hard to hear, yet when she is listened to, she can be heard from far and near. And listen to her closely, for we've got some things to do. Come on, come here and pull up a seat, for you can help on Earth Day too. Come, get a move on, stop the pollution and the waste. After all, we are the future. Make our Earth a better place. And Margaret Bowler wrote this poem in 2001 when she was 11. And because Earth really is at the center of the universe, I read a confirmation of that ancient certainty. Don't Let Them Tell You You're Not at the Center of the Universe by Dennis Overby. Misconception. The universe started someplace. Actually, the Big Bang didn't happen at a place. It happened at a time. Where did the Big Bang happen? I am often asked, as if expansion of the universe was like a hand grenade going off and the solar system and our Milky Way galaxy were shards sent flying. The universe didn't start at a place. It started at a time, namely 13.8 billion years ago, according to the best cosmological data. It's been expanding ever since, not into space, because the universe, by definition, fills all space already, so much as into time, which, as far as we know, is open-ended. It is true that everything we can now see, out to 13.8 billion years of light travel time, was once the size of a grapefruit, buzzing with hideous energies, but that grapefruit was already part of an infinite ensemble with no edge, except one made up of time. When we look out, we look into the past. The farther we look, the more deeply into the past we see. At the center is the present. Alas, there is no direction in which we can see the future, except perhaps into our own hearts and dreams. All we know is right now. So where is the center of the universe? Right here. Yes, you are the center of the universe. When Albert Einstein married space and time in his theory of relativity back in 1905, he taught us that our eyes are time machines. Nothing can go faster than the speed of light, the cosmic speed limit, so all information comes to us, to the present, from the past. And so Einstein's relativity teaches us that the center of the universe is everywhere and nowhere. It is the present, surrounded by concentric shells of the past. History is racing at you at 186,282 miles per second, the speed of light, the speed of all information. Your eyes are the cockpit of a time machine, filmy, wet orbs looking in the only direction any of us can ever look, backward. Everything we see or feel or hear, now that gravitational waves have been discovered, took some time to get here, and so comes to our senses from the past. The moon, hovering over the horizon, is an image of light that left its cratered surface, traveling at the speed of light a second and a half ago. The sun that burns your skin is 8 minutes and 19 seconds in the past. The Jupiter we see, glowering orange at the zenith these nights, is about 414 million miles out there as of this writing, or 37 minutes away in the past. The light from the center of the Milky Way, hiding behind the thick star clouds and dust lanes of Sagittarius, takes 26,000 years to get here. While it was on the way, the first primitive ice age villages grew into skyscraped metropolises. Your lover, brushing your lashes with his or her breath, is a nanosecond gone. This is more than poetry. Mathematically, in Einsteinian terms, all information and history available at any one place in the universe is known as a light cone. Everybody has one, and everybody's is slightly different, which means, in effect, that everyone's universe is a little different. There will always be some piece of information that has reached your lover, but not yet you, let alone an ET lover in the next galaxy. It gives a new definition to being alone with your thoughts. As T.S. Eliot puts it, we think of the key each in his prison. Thinking of the key, each confirms a prison. As a result, every spot in the universe is unique. There will always be a piece of it you haven't seen yet, and a piece that you have seen that nobody else has. There is no place to stand if you want to claim universal knowledge. We all need each other in order to overlap our knowledge. We don't have to stay in our prisons. Working together and sharing, we can know everything. Or as Bob Dylan once put it, I'll let you in my dream if I can be in yours. And that was by Dennis Overby, who is a science writer who specializes in physics and cosmology. He is the author of Lonely Hearts of the Cosmos, The Scientific Quest for the Secret of the Universe, and Einstein in Love, A Scientific Romance. He wrote, Don't Let Them Tell You You're Not at the Center of the Universe, for the New York Times, which occasions the second of Margaret Lee Leah Bowler's poems, The Day We Cut the Sky Open. The day we cut the sky open, loud and proud, heads held high, didn't know what we had done. First sight, first step, an alien soil. Thought we knew our own friendly satellite, couldn't satisfy us there. Dipped our toe into the soup, the sea of disarray, of misplaced constellations, developed a thirst for it, a hunger, the taste of discovery, of first contact. Neither God nor Earth rewarded us for this. So we rewarded ourselves, fashioned a trophy of lives and prayers, meaningless dates and statistics, set back, launch another mission, lost in the loops and threshes, our pool of stars and planets, sip the success from the golden cup of opportunity, awaiting the date when we, able to see the Little Dipper from a different vantage point, shall receive a note of praise, well done, not restrained by the boundaries of earth and sky. The comet caught, analyzed, once was what a hailed meeting every 2,000 years, reduced to bits of spatial flotsam and jetsam, trapped in aerogel, this cosmic object, hailed by our ancestors, worshipped. We have stolen from time, us, thieves, the opaque veil of mystery, lifted. We have drunk from the cup, for too soon, poisoning, infatuating ourselves, so madly in love with our quest for domination, have gained knowledge, power, strength, not pausing, realization pushed away by cold, damp fingers in our missions, our endless realms of charts and data, have broken our one motivation, the unknown known. Man looked at the stars from the day he crawled, gilled from the primordial soup, and wandered through years, through eons of time and history, wandering, our search ever onward, pressed by greed and want and from evil instinct to tire and cease, footprints worn away, no wind to dust them from sight, only lost by mind, an abandoned planet, our home world, empty houses, temple ruins, ghost eye vacant windows, lost and alone, adrift, the same sea, now ocean of stars that we call our home. Margaret Bowler wrote this poem in 2002 when she was 12, after reading an article in National Geographic about scientists' plans to capture part of a comet. That October was the 45th anniversary of the launch by the Soviet Union of Sputnik, the first Earth satellite. And now, The Victory Column of the Sunset Empire by Christian Krieger. The Astoria Column is 90 years old this year. Although it is intended as a monument to Astoria, it has a more volatile precedent. The story I'm about to read was written by Christian Krieger when he was an Astoria high school student in 2013. He prefaced it with an apology for his use of the noun man in reference to humankind, but doubted that in this instance, women would be too deeply insulted. The history of the world is a story of war. At the dawn, when man gained sentience and lost innocence, he picked up a club. He never put it down for hundreds of millennia, except briefly to pick up something of greater offensive utility, and so proceeded through the ages, exchanging branch for flint, flint for blade, blade for arrow, arrow for ball, and ball for bullet, until he held at last the pinnacle of his yearning. Something which he could make the earth itself shudder, which he could use to rain down fire like the gods he had revered. But long before he held the atom, he held simpler tools of war, and also of craft, and he began to make his successes in enterprises of violence with artifacts. The original monument to war was probably painted on a cave wall in Paleolithic times, and as the reason for it has long faded with the pigment, it is doubtful whether any academic can positively say that it was made in celebration or mourning. But there can be no doubt that the mature, grand monuments of classical antiquity were intended for the former purpose. Victory columns are monuments erected to glorify successful revolutions, battles, and wars. One of the first such monuments, Trajan's Column, was built to commemorate the Roman Emperor Trajan's victory in the Dacian Wars. It also recorded said victory in detail, albeit historically dubious detail, on a long bas-relief mural which winds around it. The column is 125 feet tall, and the 53-ton Capitol block had to be lifted to the top. If any of those specifics sound familiar, that is no coincidence. Our very own Astoria Column was modeled after Trajan's Column. It is also 125 feet tall with a spiraling frieze. The frieze may be similar to its source of inspiration in that it glosses over some of the more unimportant details or glorifies the important ones. Indeed, Astoria's column bears more than a superficial, intentional resemblance to Trajan's Column. It is also a victory column. It and the community of Europeans surrounding it would not be there if not for the Indian Wars. No history lesson is necessary to bolster this fact. It undeniably stands alone without support. As a proud people, to put it tritely, was displaced by the European settlers of the majestic Pacific Northwest. Many were murdered in the same spirit as the atrocities committed by the conquering kings of ages past in distant lands. Many bona fide apologies have been given already for that injustice, and this is not another. Rather, it is an apology that all the apologies that came before were in vain. History played out as it did, and the things which were done and can't be changed. Those who wronged directly are dead, and those who were directly wronged are dead likewise. But man can still unlearn what he learned so long ago, the art of war. He retains, hypothetically, the ability to learn. The column is a monument to great things, truly, but take that with a grain of salt. Those things are, in fact, terrible when viewed objectively. Who can fault anyone who sees the victory column erected by the foreign invaders of the Sunset Empire and understands what it really signifies? We should keep it where it is forever to help us remember. and let us never again have reason to raise another like it. And that was by Christian Krieger. And in recognition of the anniversary of the end of at least one war, the Vietnam War, I wish to read a poem written by Timothy Clover while he was in Vietnam. The Gift. What can I give you, child of the Asian sun, child of the holy rain? What shall it be? You stand by the road, hopeful-eyed tiny one, silent your cry, though it echoes inside me, burns in the hollowness that once was a boy like you, when the future was vague and the whole world was new. But when you are six, you will have had twice the years I've had, learning that no one cares if you are good or bad, when you're a gook and I'm a white man, who preaches ideals and takes what he can. Tyranny's only a fact of your life, my friend. Do you expect me to help you pretend that I'll give you your freedom, the better to live? I've got nothing inside me, so here's what I'll give. I'll bury your father, who died by my hand, and build you a desert on your green land. You'll have soldiers for brothers, and if you want more, for your sister or mother, I'll give you a whore. Why do you stare at me, shining-eyed, ageless one? Am I accused of betraying a trust? Wheels are turning, and leave you, I must. Your home is all burning. I give you the dust. Timothy Clover was killed in action in Vietnam on May 22, 1968. His poem was printed posthumously in Demilitarized Zones, Veterans After Vietnam, published by Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And something I wrote, Post-Vietnam Syndrome. The Vietnam War ended on April 30th, 1975, and perhaps the only certainty about that war will be the absence of grand 50th anniversary pageants of its end or for any of its battles, as for Gettysburg in 1913 or World War II's Normandy D-Day in June 1994. The end of the Civil War in 1865 and World War II in 1945 are vividly remembered and eulogized. Vietnam's end remains vague and indistinct. America's participation and withdrawal continued to be perceived as inconclusive, coupled with deep resistance to declare it a lost war. Civil War veterans were honored until the last of them, an ancient Confederate, died in 1959, although his claim as a veteran is debated. World War II veterans, though often negligently regarded in the post-war Cold War period, experienced a golden anniversary comeback, resplendent with apologetic respect and genuflection for saving freedom. World War I veterans, who fought the war to end all wars, were honored for saving the world for democracy. Vietnam veterans do not claim to have saved anything. As with Korean War veterans, their war was nebulous, though deadly and costly. Both wars were eruptions along a fault line of polarity that was otherwise a global Cold War. In themselves, the wars in Korea and Vietnam meant little except to the hard luck victims who were sacrificed for world power. Korea and Vietnam were civil wars within artificially subdivided nations and cultures, irrespective of political ideological conflict. The proclaimed issues and superpower influences and interventions in both wars were muddled and unconvincing. Korea and Vietnam were low-stake wars, more bluff than real cards, though hundreds of thousands of real persons perished and anonymous millions were handicapped for life, psychologically as well as physically. The Vietnam War was ambiguous and off-center. Combat veterans were discouraged from revealing themselves if they wished to reintegrate into the hostile yet continually oblivious society they thought they were defending in a far-off part of the world that was claimed to be of strategic as well as ideological necessity to the United States. Soon enough, the propaganda was revealed as sham, yet very few actively reflected the growing public disaffection with the war. The larger public preferred to distance itself through self-hypnotic, also drug-induced, numbness. The Vietnam War remains contradictory, at once troubling and unsettled in the American psyche, yet dimming into historical oblivion, obscured by the larger afterglow of World War II on the receding horizon. Both wars fade into the antiquity of a previous century, soon as distant in memory as the Iliad. the United States seems to regard Vietnam as only an old war and a distasteful part of its past, rather than as a separate nation and people, currently, as always, making its own history. A large number of Vietnam veterans wish for a personal reconciliation with Vietnam, though many might disagree the U.S. owes an apology for making war there as a Cold War counterbalance to Soviet Chinese power. A significant number of Vietnam veterans organized to stop the war and were castigated as traitors by the pro-war faction and baby killers by the anti-war. Looking up old enemies is a cathartic act, necessary for former combatants to develop a holistic perspective of a war. And the Vietnam soldiers are growing old. Soon they will be this nation's most aged veterans, following the exit of the Korean vets. World War II veterans are almost all gone, and no one is left from World War I. America's preoccupation with newer wars will undoubtedly make up the shortfall. And I finish this program with another poem, the third one, by Margaret Bowler, After War. Here, over blood-stained, craggy, barren soil, the tattered banner waves, high above the final battlegrounds, where hundreds slaughtered lie in eternal sleep, their blood tinting the dirt. The banner flies, held up by the wind, witness to desolation, until time itself tears the fabric remnants from the pole, and everything crumbles to dust. Margaret Bowler was 11 when she wrote this poem in 2001. This has been Michael McCusker. Happy May Day.